Topic 1, Invasion of Privacy, Part 4. This is Lynn Kastner, Executive Director of the Minnesota Civil Liberties Union, bringing you the fourth in a series of programs dealing with the civil liberties implications of invasions of privacy. On tonight's program, C. Paul Jones, State Public Defender, and Senator Wayne G. Popham, representing in 1965 the 35th Legislative District in Minnesota, will discuss with me wiretapping in Minnesota. In the first of these programs, Professor Alan Weston of Columbia University gave a discussion of the developing technology of the instruments of wiretapping and electronics eavesdropping and the civil liberties implications in the increasing frequency of their use. In the second program, Dr. David K. Berninghausen, Director of the Library School of the University of Minnesota, discussed the literature in the field of invasion of privacy. Dr. Berninghausen prepared a bibliography on the literature of invasion of privacy, and the Minnesota Civil Liberties Union has reproduced this bibliography for its members and the interested public. If you would like a copy of this challenging document, send your name and address to Minnesota Civil Liberties Union, Upper Midwest Building, Minneapolis, Minnesota. Also on the second program was Professor Ellingston, a criminologist at the University of Minnesota Law School, who discussed invasion of privacy of our social and welfare agencies. In the third program, Professor Paul Murphy of the History Department of the University of Minnesota discussed the history of the law of invasion of privacy. And Dr. E.G. Williamson, Dean of Students of the University of Minnesota, discussed invasion of privacy and students' records. With me today is Senator Wayne G. Popham, representing in 1965 the 35th District in the State Senate, and C. Paul Jones, recently appointed State Public Defender. We are discussing wiretapping in the state of Minnesota. The American Civil Liberties Union has long had a position on wiretapping and electronics eavesdropping. And in the last session of the legislature, Senator Popham introduced a bill which would restrict the use of wiretapping and electronics eavesdropping equipment by the private sector and would grant, under certain restrictions, the limited use of such devices by law enforcement officers. At that time, the Minnesota Civil Liberties Union took the position that the right to privacy is among the most fundamental of the rights of American citizenship. When this nation was founded, and for 150 years thereafter, invasions of privacy involved primarily physical entry into a man's home. Legal guarantees such as the Fourth Amendment to the United States Constitution were designed to safeguard against these intrusions. During the past 25 years, however, modern technology has made possible more insidious invasions of a man's privacy. Eavesdropping devices are now in common use. The Minnesota branch of the American Civil Liberties Union strongly supports the legislation recently introduced in the Minnesota legislature in 1965, which would have outlawed the use of such devices. This legislation is urgently needed to extend our modern conditions, the traditional securities embodied in our law. Unfortunately, that bill before the legislature would not have merely prohibited the use of eavesdropping devices. It would have authorized the police to employ such equipment under certain circumstances. The MCLU opposed that portion of the bill on the grounds that it contravened both the policy of the Fourth Amendment and of the Federal Communications Act. In our history, it has long been reflected that a persistent conflict existed between the individual's right to be let alone and the need for infringing that right in order to protect society against lawbreakers. In 16th century England, the Stationers' Company was granted authority to search for and seize seditious libel and writings contrary to the form of any statute, act, or proclamation made or to be made. The stationers who were authorized to search anywhere, anytime, for seditious matter used these general warrants on behalf of the state to seek out and destroy Puritan and other dissenting literature. Subsequent regimes in the 16th, 17th, and 18th century England reaffirmed these powers for their own purposes until the 1760s, when such powers were held unlawful. While these practices were being curbed in England, Parliament granted colonial revenue officers complete discretion to search, in suspected places, for smuggled goods by means of writs of assistance. The struggle against these writs were described by John Adams as the first acts of opposition to the arbitrary claims of Great Britain. Revulsion against general warrants and writs of assistance led the framers of the Constitution to include in the Fourth Amendment the express ban on general warrants. Quote, no warrant shall issue but upon probable cause, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the person or things to be seized, unquote. The Supreme Court has refined this and developed the corollary doctrine that a search can be made only to obtain certain objects, tools of crime, fruits of crime, contraband, or goods upon which an excise duty should have been paid. In other words, the court has refused to allow police officers to search a person's home merely to obtain evidence of crime. I'd like to ask first, both of our guests today, do law enforcement officers in Minnesota use wiretapping and electronics eavesdropping devices?
Yes, I think it's pretty well conceded that not only in the state of Minnesota, but in the other states in the United States, these devices are used and used with quite a bit of frequency.
Mr. Jones, does, to your knowledge, have there been any cases in Minnesota dealing with either the use of wiretapping devices or the admissibility of its evidence?
To the best of my knowledge, there have been no actual court cases in this regard. There have been police investigations, however, which have used these devices, but the information has been stopped before it got to court, or the parties involved were not aware that they had been used and therefore did not ask the courts for protection.
Senator Popham, what has been your experience in this regard?
Well, I have not personally been involved in any matters where this was used, but I have discussed this general problem with a number of attorneys who practice in the field of criminal law, and they have indicated to me a number of experiences which they have had where various forms of electronic eavesdropping or wiretapping have been utilized by law enforcement officials, both state and federal.
I wonder if we might spend a couple of minutes and review what the law is as set forth in federal enactments, state enactments, and what the Supreme Court and our other courts' position have been as to the use of wiretapping and electronics eavesdropping devices and as to the admissibility of its evidence.
Maybe I could step into that. The United States Supreme Court has stated over the past years that as far as wiretapping is concerned, if there's an actual contact or an actual trespass or an actual entry into a person's home, for example, in order to place the wiretap, the information obtained from that device is not admissible in court, and as such, the police have in effect wasted their time. On the other hand, the court as of yet has not stated that if the police use one of the more modern devices where it's not necessary to actually enter a person's home or to come into contact with any portion of that home, that type of evidence is inadmissible. We're all pretty familiar with the microphones that are used by the broadcasters at football games, the big device that looks like a big shotgun or other kind of weapon along the sidelines. These are directional microphones which do pick up what the quarterback is saying, do pick up the contact. This same sort of device on a more refined basis and on a smaller basis is still permitted by the United States Supreme Court, and obviously there is no contact with the person or his house in the use, and with one of these devices you can pick up conversation from many hundreds of feet away and almost better than if you were standing there adjacent to people listening. Now, in addition to the constitutional prohibition against the invasion of privacy, The Congress of the United States, back in roughly 1934, passed a statute which prohibits the interception of messages electronically and prohibits the use or dissemination of this information. And really what the federal courts have done is to use this statute to prohibit the use of the evidence obtained where you do have a wiretapping situation. This, however, applies only to the federal courts, and there's a great deal of confusion in the state courts as to what they can and cannot do. Minnesota has yet to rule on the question, and how they're going to rule, you can get into a great deal of debate with other lawyers as to how they will rule and how they should rule.
The federal legislation that you speak about, Mr. Jones, this is Section 605 of the Federal Communications Act, isn't it?
That's right.
And isn't it an open question yet whether states can pass legislation which would permit the use and divulgence of information as prohibited in the FCC Act?
That's right, and that is part of the reason for the confusion in the states as to what type of legislation, if any, they can use. The federal act does prohibit the interception of these messages if it is used. I might go back just a minute here and state that as far as the United States Justice Department is concerned, this information is not used and it is not disseminated as long as it is merely utilized within the agency itself. So as long as the FBI uses their wiretap information only within that agency, only within the Justice Department, it is the Justice Department position that this is not a violation of the federal act, and so far the courts have not been called upon to rule on this particular aspect of this matter.
It might be useful to mention here that ACLU's position has consistently been that the word use in Section 605 would prohibit just the wiretapping, even though there is no divulgence beyond the agency. And in this respect, there is a conflict between the views of the U.S. Attorney General and our position as to what the act is. And of course, as you pointed out, this is still an open question as far as the courts are concerned. You mentioned the use of such devices as the rifle microphone, if I can call it that, that on Saturday afternoons can allow the television viewing audience to hear the discussions inside the huddle. We've had members send us such interesting advertisements in Adventure and other popular magazines which picture a clean-cut looking law enforcement officer with a stethoscope type object touching the wall, on the other side of which is a couple having a discussion saying detective phones available now at a reasonable price, have fun, exclamation point, overhear conversations in the next room, and such things as the parabolic pickup device, which looks like a small radar screen with a little flower-like antenna in the middle of it, and for some 15 and some dollars you can overhear voices through an open window in a room hundreds of feet away. If you don't wish to wire this into a tape recorder or some other recording device, but merely listen to it through earphones, the cost is $15 or less. So it's become increasingly come to our knowledge increasingly that the use of these devices and the development of these devices is fairly widespread. In this connection, you've mentioned some of the cases that have dealt with the use of wiretapping and other devices which form a trespass. These cases, even if they extended to the use of these devices, would only restrict the use of the devices by law enforcement officers, wouldn't they? And not reach the use by the general public.
That's right, and the reason for this is when it's used by the general public, the information is not utilized in court. That's oversimplified, but there is no way to stop this, and actually the problem is not altogether a police invasion problem, although we keep talking about it that way. Really, I think about 9 out of 10 wiretaps or the use of electronic eavesdropping devices is done by industry, by business, by nosy people, aside from law enforcement agencies, and I think that should be made very clear.
I think that points out the real need for controls of the abuse of these devices, which invade our privacy, and I think brings us to the bill Senator Popham introduced in the last legislature, which would restrict the use of these devices by private or non-public persons. I wonder, Senator Popham, if you could describe what your bill is and briefly what it would do.
Well, as we've been discussing, the law presently is in a state of confusion. People will disagree, perhaps, on what should be the proper resolution of these conflicts between the interests of society and the interests of the individual and his privacy, but everyone is in agreement that some action is needed. Congress has failed to act in 25 years to resolve this conflict that exists under the Federal Communications Act. And well, this is true, although a number of attempts have been made to pass legislation which would clear up the use of wiretapping by law enforcement personnel. There is no argument by anyone that private individuals should be allowed to eavesdrop either electronically or by wiretapping. And the legislation that was introduced in the Minnesota State Legislature in 1965, Senate File 915, would have prohibited all forms of eavesdropping by private individuals. It would have prohibited the possession or use of eavesdropping equipment. I think there is no effective way of policing a prohibition on the use of this type of equipment unless you also take the position that its actual possession or use is prohibited. In other words, this is what we do in the case of sawed-off shotguns or machine guns, narcotics. The actual possession is prohibited. The bill, therefore, would outlaw all forms of eavesdropping as it is permitted today, including wiretapping, with the sole exception that certain law enforcement personnel in restricted situations could apply for a search warrant to the district court, and upon a showing of probable cause, as they have to make in the case of any form of search warrant, could get a restricted order. This one area then would be the only place in which any type of eavesdropping would be permitted. The problem here of just how to define what should be permissible eavesdropping by law enforcement personnel is really the heart of this entire problem, I think. There is some question as to whether it is possible, with the maintenance of the necessary safeguards, to permit any type of eavesdropping by law enforcement personnel. The United States Supreme Court has been deeply concerned with this problem in a series of cases that go back to 1928, has raised questions about the permissibility of different forms of eavesdropping. And while the court has never as yet held this to be prohibited under the Fourth Amendment, they have raised objections to different forms of eavesdropping as it has been practiced by law enforcement officials in certain situations. But a number of the justices that have been most concerned about protecting the right of privacy have recognized that under certain proper safeguards, it may be a legitimate tool for our law enforcement officials to prevent crime. For example, Chief Justice Warren said in the Lopez case in 1960, I also share the opinion of Mr. Justice Brennan that the fantastic advances in the field of electronic communication constitute a great danger to the privacy of the individual. However, I do not believe that as a result, all uses of such devices should be proscribed either as unconstitutional or as unfair law enforcement methods. The problem then is, what are the proper safeguards that would permit this use consistent with our traditional interests, our constitutional protections? I might say that I think personally, even though the United States Supreme Court has never held the Fourth Amendment to apply to eavesdropping, that it should so hold, and I anticipate that at some point, inevitably, the court is going to so hold. The Fourth Amendment, of course, provides that the right of the people is to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures. And no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. Now, I think clearly you have to recognize here that there is an invasion of privacy involved when you're talking about any form of eavesdropping. And therefore, the approach of the Minnesota legislation was that it had to satisfy the traditional concepts of search and seizure as the United States Supreme Court has interpreted them down through the years since the adoption of our federal constitution. Basically, if this is true, and if you make the assumption that this does have to satisfy the requirements of search and seizure, you're then confronted with an analysis, really, of what is a search and seizure, and what is involved. Basically, I think it's an invasion of privacy. In the one hand, it's visual. Law enforcement officials come into a building, into a home, into a room, and make a visual inspection of what they find there. In the other case, the invasion of privacy is auditory, and there is a listening to conversation, which is intended to be equally private. In both cases, though, there is an unrestricted invasion of privacy. I think many times the public tends to be unaware of this fact, just because so few people ever are involved in a search warrant. Search warrant can only issue where there is a showing of probable cause that there has been a crime committed and that the party involved is somehow involved in it. And since this applies to so few people, I think the general public doesn't realize that theoretically, at any hour of the day or night, a search warrant could issue for a search of their home or their place of business. But the important thing is that there be a restriction on an unlimited or arbitrary or capricious invasion of privacy. I think the public permits the present form of physical invasion of privacy simply because experience has shown since the founding of the country that the way in which the courts have interpreted the requirement of probable cause and the burdens that they place on law enforcement officials to get a search warrant has proven satisfactory to prevent a serious disturbance with the rights of the public. So I think basically it's a matter here of trying to devise technical requirements in a form of legislation which will provide the proper restraints on law enforcement officials and permit them to make this kind of a search, an electronic search, only where they would be permitted to make the conventional or physical type of search. And in fact, it's my personal feeling that there should be even greater restrictions here than those that we have experienced in the other area, at least until we have had some greater experience to prove that some of those restraints maybe are unnecessary restriction on law enforcement. The details of this bill have frequently been compared to the legislation that's been in effect in the state of New York since 1938. This legislation has been the subject of a lot of study by lawyers, by groups such as the American Civil Liberties Union, by law enforcement officials, law professors, and much of this comment has been extremely critical, justifiably so, in my opinion. The New York legislation, even though it has had the support of the bar associations in New York State, fails to contain many of the safeguards that are required under the Minnesota legislation, Minnesota proposed legislation. Here, in order to do any kind of electronic searching, law enforcement officials would have to go to court to get a warrant. The application would be limited to the county attorney or to the state attorney general. Unlike New York State, we would not permit just any law enforcement official to go and get a warrant. Other distinctions with the New York legislation would be the fact that there must be a detailed setting forth of the grounds for getting the warrant. And the warrant would be available only where there is no other means available to obtain the necessary evidence. The facilities involved would have to be owned by the party in question, and this would eliminate the tapping of public telephones. This is one of the vices that has been severely condemned in New York State, and this would be prohibited under the Minnesota legislation. Other distinctions are that there would have to be a complete preservation of this information, and the defendant would have to be given notice of it so that he could move to suppress the evidence just like he would in an ordinary search warrant. In New York State, there is no requirement of notice, and a person can be the subject of eavesdropping and never ever be aware of it. And the evidence may be used against him in court, and he isn't even aware of the fact, and his counsel has no way of moving to suppress it. The period involved is much restricted, and I think perhaps one other restriction that is important, the legislation was made expressly subject to the Federal Communications Act, which would mean that there could be no use of wiretapping evidence in the state of Minnesota, even if this bill would become law, until the Congress had acted to provide some type of authorization in the Federal Communications Act. There are a number of other restrictions in the bill also that would go beyond the New York Act, but these perhaps are some of the significant ones.
Perhaps before we discuss some of the limitations that are placed in your act, we might first look at the question of whether there's a need for police use of wiretap evidence. In response to inquiries from the Senate Subcommittee, U.S. Senate, on Constitutional Rights, only 13 out of 45 attorneys general called for wiretapping authority in law enforcement use. And I think it would be interesting to find out what the position of law enforcement agencies has been in Minnesota as to the need for it here.
Well, I think probably it should be recognized that in Minnesota we have a pretty fair law enforcement atmosphere. We don't have the problems of Chicago, we don't have the problems of New York, we don't have the problems of Los Angeles. Matter of fact, our situation is such that we can now solve problems before they do arise as our population goes up, which is a good, healthy situation. Your law enforcement officers do state, and I think with some justification, that in your professional type of crime, your professional criminal situation, that eavesdropping devices are helpful in apprehending this type of an individual. And because of the fact that they are professionals, they are harder to catch than Billy Smith, who makes a mistake and never will again. And as such, they want the use of this device or these devices in those few cases where they are dealing with a professional organization. In this sense of the word, I think you can generalize that the law enforcement agencies in Minnesota do wish these devices in this limited area. And I think you should also note, however, that there is no invasion of privacy, according to the United States Supreme Court anyway, where one of the parties to the conversation agrees that there should be interception. And if I want to tape my conversation with my wife, or I want somebody else to do that, and I give them permission to do so, this is not in violation of any federal constitutional prohibitions. And often, of course, law enforcement officials do tap, in the sense of the word, where they do have the permission of one of the two parties.
Senator Popham, in the last legislative session, was there an expression by any of the law enforcement agencies as to the need for it in Minnesota?
I don't believe that there was any testimony at any of the hearings by any law enforcement officials, either pro or con, any element of the legislation or as to the legislation itself. I did have correspondence with some law enforcement officials concerning certain suggested changes in the bill, but as far as I know, there is no formal agency such as the State Sheriff's Association or any other law enforcement body in the state that has officially or formally taken any stand on legislation in this area. This type of legislation tends to be somewhat controversial, and I think that many elected officials in the law enforcement field are concerned about advocating this type of legislation, although privately they will indicate the need which they feel for a properly restricted type of use.
Senator, at the hearings that you held on this bill, the Minnesota Civil Liberties Union appeared and testified to your committee as to its position. I recall at that time also the telephone company appeared, and subsequent to the first hearing appeared a second time and pointed out that they were concerned with the public confidence in the privacy of the telephone system if the bill were passed. In an editorial in the Minneapolis Star appearing May 12, 1965, the editorial pointed out the concern of the telephone company and also pointed out that many persons would have doubts about allowing even rare court-supervised wiretapping, but also calling attention to the abuse in the practices and concluding that the bill would be a significant step forward. I think it might be interesting to ask you if you have any information, further information, as to the telephone company's position in regard to this legislation, either in Minnesota or elsewhere.
Well, the telephone company has had this matter under continuing study, I think, both locally and on a national basis. I'm not acquainted with their official position as of right now, although it was in opposition to this legislation as of the last legislative session, as you point out. I do know that since that time, however, United States Senator Long, who is the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Subcommittee investigating this problem of invasion of privacy, has held hearings in various parts of the country. And at one of these hearings here in the Midwest, officials of the telephone company involved testified before this Senate committee that they had cooperated with law enforcement officials to permit wiretapping. And this, of course, was under a situation where there was no requirement for a warrant or judicial supervision. This, to me, is a real problem, because while I personally feel that there is a narrow, a legitimate area for use by law enforcement officials, I feel very strongly that this should in all cases be under the supervision of a court, and that it shouldn't be a matter merely of cooperation between a law enforcement official and an official of the telephone company. This testimony that came out in this congressional hearing has received a great deal of publicity. It was written up in the New York Times and has been a source of comment by some writers in the field. I don't know what this signifies as far as what the future policy of the telephone company is going to be. But I think that if the public is apprehensive about wiretapping today, it would be because there is no judicial supervision, and they have no way of knowing whether right now their telephone is being tapped merely on a private arrangement, and that the public confidence would really be served here if people knew that there couldn't be any kind of unrestricted wiretapping, but they had to go before a magistrate. Now, I can see an argument that even that procedure shouldn't be permitted, but certainly it is hard for me to see how anyone can really object at least to the first step of requiring judicial restraint. That at least is an improvement over the present situation.
In your bill, is there a protection against the infringement of the privilege, which is which in Minnesota law extends to communications between husband and wife, attorney and client, doctor and patient?
Yes, this is another distinction in the New York legislation. This bill would provide that all privileged communications would be suppressed. They would not constitute the ground for the obtaining of a warrant in the first place, and any such evidence obtained would be sealed and subject to severe penalties for disclosure. This, of course, is another distinction in the conventional type of search, where under the ordinary search warrant, if law enforcement officials come across information during a search which is really confidential or privileged, why, there is no restriction on its use.
I'd like to thank Senator Popham and Mr. Jones for being with me today and discussing wiretapping in Minnesota. The bill Senator Popham and Mr. Jones have been discussing was presented to the 1965 legislature. It was not passed. In March 1962, the National American Civil Liberties Union put out a pamphlet, The Wiretapping Problem Today. In its recommendations in the pamphlet, the ACLU said, in one respect, those who call for wiretapping legislation are right. The present situation is bad, but this is not because the statute is vague and the prosecutor does not know what he may and may not do. Section 605 flatly bans all wiretapping, and it is clearly unlawful for state judges and prosecutory officials to participate in the commission of a federal crime by procuring wiretap information and admitting it into evidence. Section 605 should therefore be tightened as follows. Continuing quoting from the ACLU pamphlet. 1. All evidence obtained directly or indirectly from a wiretap should be rendered inadmissible in any court, to eliminate the spectacle of a court sworn to uphold the laws of the United States participating in the commission of a federal crime by aiding and abetting the divulgence of illegally obtained and illegally disclosed evidence. Recommendation 2. The law should be changed to make it perfectly clear that an offense is committed by either interception or divulgence of the information. The statute does, in fact, state this now, but within the Department of Justice and other agencies, it has been interpreted to allow interception so long as the information is not divulged outside the agency. Recommendation 3. A defendant should be permitted to object to the admission in evidence of wiretap evidence, even though he is not a party to the conversation, for any person adversely affected has the right to protest the commission of a federal offense by a court. Recommendation 4. Grand juries should be convened periodically to inquire into the enforcement of the law against wiretapping. Because of the record of unauthorized use of wiretapping, the blackmail temptation and other corruption facilitated by this practice, and the ever-increasing growth of new eavesdropping devices, there must be constant review of the electronic eavesdropping problem. Recommendation 5. A private remedy for unlawful wiretapping should be statutorily established with minimum punitive damages plus counsel fees. If the possibility of financial loss to the wiretapper exists, unlawful wiretapping can be deterred. Recommendation 6. The various telephone companies should be required to lock all feeder and terminal boxes and to report all instances of wiretapping immediately to the federal authorities. In a free society, the end of law enforcement does not justify any and all means. Even if far more convictions could be obtained through the use of such procedures as general warrants, for example, we should choose not to use them. Since the case for wiretapping and other forms of electronic eavesdropping is so weak, an irreparable injury to freedom and security so serious, there is no justification for any such authority. So concludes the pamphlet put out by the ACLU on the wiretapping today. If you would be interested in this pamphlet on wiretapping, or if you would like a bibliography prepared under the direction of Dr. David K. Berninghausen, reviewing the literature on invasion of privacy, send your name and address to Minnesota Civil Liberties Union, Upper Midwest Building, Minneapolis, Minnesota. In future programs, the Minnesota Civil Liberties Union will discuss censorship of obscenity, academic freedom of teachers and students, issues of separation of church and state, civil liberties problems involved in local and state police practices, and other civil liberties issues of concern today. We welcome your comment, either on our programs or suggestions for civil liberties topics you would like to hear in future programs. Direct your communications to the Minnesota Civil Liberties Union, Upper Midwest Building, Minneapolis, Minnesota. This has been the 10th in a series of civil liberties educational programs produced by MCLU as a public service.